Anyway, welcome. Yes, as sorry, Matty said, we're 25 of us, so in Tallahassee, which is actually quite meaningful given what we're doing tonight. So, as you probably, most of you are quite bored of hearing by now. This year, since last September, in our Sangha nights, we're looking at the three jewels of Buddhism, the three precious things, the three things that are most valued and prized in the Buddhist tradition. So the Buddha, the ideal of human enlightenment, the ideal of human potential and what we could become. The Dharma, the truth and the teachings that give us the path to that goal. And the Sangha, the community of Buddhist practitioners without which, without the support of which and help of which we wouldn't be able to follow that path. So, yeah, we're looking at those three jewels over this year, and tonight we're making a transition. So we're making a transition from exploring the different aspects of the Buddha, as we've been doing since September, to looking at the Dharma, the truth, the teaching. Yeah, so over the past, last little bit of looking at the Buddha, we've been doing that in terms of what's called the mandala of the five Buddhas, of which this is a really awful representation. So the mandala of the five Buddhas is a sort of geographic representation, but it's looking at the nature of the enlightened mind in terms of five very powerful symbols that communicate aspects of the enlightened mind, aspects of the Buddha, and also aspects of the way we approach the Buddha. So we've been working our way around the mandala. We've looked at Akshobhya with his mirror-like wisdom, as the blue Buddha of the East and of the dawn, sort of associated with the cool, intellectual, slightly intellectual, certainly wisdom aspects. Ratnasambhava, the golden, rich, golden Buddha of the South, sort of associated with beauty and giving and gifts. Amitabha, associated with meditation and positive emotion, and Amoghasiddhi, associated with action, the path of action and karma. And last week we heard about Virochana, who sits like the sun in the solar system in the middle of this symbol, Virochana, the illuminator. The great illuminator, the great source of light who sits at the center of this mandala. So we sort of looked at aspects of all of those. And Virochana's symbol, as you heard last week, is the golden wheel of the Dharma, the golden wheel of the teaching. And his hand gesture is called the gesture of turning the wheel of the Dharma. I can't do it. Somebody do it. It's very complicated, it seems to me. Something like this. But it's the gesture of turning the wheel of the Dharma. And when the historical Buddha gave his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths in the Deer Park at Varanasi, where our brethren are, this is referred to as the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma. This is when the Buddha first turned the wheel of the Dharma. And the wheel of the Dharma has been rolling ever since. It's rolled all the way down to us. And wherever the Dharma rolls, it has an effect. It brings order. It brings harmony. It creates a sort of kingdom of comely action and harmonious relationships. The wheel is an ancient Indian symbol of royalty, of kingship, particularly of positive kingship, of ruling, enlightened kingship, if you like. And of the harmony that a wise king can create in their realm. So a wheel-rolling king is a monarch who rules by the Dharma, who rules by the truth, who creates a harmonious kingdom of beauty and peace. And the Buddha is likened to a spiritual king, hence the wheel. The Buddha is likened to a spiritual king, more important than a secular king, who creates a different sort of kingdom, a spiritual kingdom of peace and harmony and beauty by rolling this wheel of the Dharma, the healing, harmonizing wheel of the Dharma out over the world. So Virochana represents this aspect of enlightenment. He represents the Buddha as teacher, the Buddha whose teachings go out into the world and transform the world. Or even better, we could say he represents the Buddha as illuminator, hence his name, illuminator. Virochana means illuminator. So Virochana sits at like the sun at the centre of the mandala, bringing order and harmony like the sun in the solar system, and bathing the world in the sunlight of the Dharma. And I mean, I think that's a very good, it's a very good analogy. I think the Dharma is very much like light. It's like a light that illuminates our world. Our world would be a dark place indeed without some higher spiritual teachings that give us guidance and direction and meaning. So I'm always very impressed by some lines in the Sevenfold Puja that we do, where we ask the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to shine the light of the Dharma so that life in this world may not grow dark. It does not grow dark. Sometimes that can almost send a shiver down my neck, that line, so that light in this world does not grow dark, so that life in this world does not grow dark. Because our world could be a very dark place indeed. It could be a nightmarish place. It has been in the past a nightmarish place. It still is a nightmarish place in certain places on our planet right now, where the light of something like the Dharma doesn't reach. So there have been, and there still are, and there will be again, places where evil rules, very nightmarish places. These can be outer places, spots on a map. Places on a map. They can also be inner places. Places inside the skulls and hearts of human beings, where the Dharma doesn't shine. And if we can imagine what it's like to be in a black place like that, it's perhaps sometimes difficult in a nice country like the UK, where most of our friends are sort of quite nice people. And, but there's places you can go where you can get a sense that it's a possibility, and we don't want it to happen. And if we can imagine what it's like to be in a black place like that, it's very, very scary. It's very, very scary. If we can imagine that, we will really mean it when we say, please shine the light of the Dharma so that life in this world does not grow dark. We'll really mean it. But even at a sort of bit of a less extreme level, I mean really dark, even at a less extreme level, I reckon that to an enlightened being, the place that most of us ordinary human beings live looks like a little bit dark. It's a pretty dark place. There's a very common image used in Buddhism, which I think is quite telling, where we unenlightened beings are pictured as blind people. So you often get this imagery. So we're blind people. Blind in our foolishness and delusion. And we're constantly sort of blundering around, walking into doors, tripping over things, falling into ditches full of filth. Sometimes we get one blind person says, follow me! We all grab hold of him and he leads us all off and then we all fall in a ditch. And we're blundering around, causing ourselves all sorts of suffering. It's a really common image, it's often depicted and it's often talked about. We're blundering around, causing ourselves all sorts of suffering in our search for happiness, because in the darkness we can't see where it is. We're looking in the wrong place, wandering around. We all of us need the lamp of the Dharma, even if we aren't enlightened. Maybe the light of the some of the teachings can be a bit like a sort of torch with a rather faulty battery that we at least can see. Ah, I'm not going down there. Even if we're not enlightened, the light of the Dharma can be a bit of a torch. So the historical Buddha was an illuminator. He lit things up. The light of the Dharma lights things up, and that light comes right down to us. His teachings and his Sangha and the legacy he founded are rightly called a light in the world. And it's this that Virochana symbolizes, is this aspect of the activity of the Buddha, lighting up the world. through the Dharma. And we as the Buddha's disciples, we're actually part of that activity. It wouldn't happen without us. We're part of the activity of shining the lamp of the Dharma into the world. That's part of our practice. So that's what Virochana represents. So he's the perfect transition. He's the perfect transition from, he's the perfect symbol to make this transition from talking about the Buddha to talking about the Dharma. And he's also, it's really useful to do this because we need to keep that connection in our mind. We need to have that connection in our mind between the Buddha, the enlightened being, the enlightened mind, and the Dharma. That's really, really important because the Dharma is not just any old, fairly helpful teachings that somebody came up with. It's not something that somebody clever sat down and thought out. It's not the product of intellectual thought. The Dharma is a product of the enlightened mind. It is the enlightened mind speaking to us, trying to get through to us. There's a Chinese Buddhist text, I think it's sometimes described as an apocryphal style of Chinese Buddhist text, which I really like, which talks about the Buddha as someone who's awake, that's what Buddha means, somebody who's awake, and us lot as being fast asleep and dreaming. And it talks about the Dharma as being the Buddha trying to talk to us in our dreaming state. So we're in a dream, chasing things that look really attractive in a dream, running away from things that look really frightening in a dream, and the Buddha's awake and trying to get through to us. And so the sutra says the Buddha has to talk to us in the language of dreams. He can't use the language of waking life because we wouldn't understand it. He has to use a language that we would understand in our dreaming state. We're cut off from the enlightened mind by our deluded state, and the Dharma is the enlightened mind trying to reach us, trying to get through to us in a language we can understand. So this idea of dreaming and waking is one way of putting that. It's as though something is trying to get through to us from another dimension, from a deeper, a higher dimension, from a higher realm. Trying to talk to us in a language we can understand. So Sangharakshita talks about this. He talks about the Dharma in terms of, first of all, reality. The Buddha, if you like, reality, which has to come sort of down to us. It sort of steps down in levels. It steps down in levels. It steps down first to, that's what we might call, roughly, visionary experience, or archetypal experience. But it steps down further into concepts, intellectual concepts, ideas that we can understand with the rational mind. But then these have to be expressed in words, which don't fully express the concepts. We all know that because we sometimes get ideas and you think, how can I possibly say that? So words don't necessarily fully match the concepts, but then we have to approach the Dharma, most of us, through the words. For most of us to understand it before it can speak to us, it has to be translated, it has to be stepped down through all these levels into words, losing something at each level. So it's really important to remember the words themselves are not the true Dharma. They're just a sort of rough representation that's stepped down several levels. So if we think we can understand the Dharma completely because we've understood the words, we've missed something. And we can get into all sorts of trouble. So the words are really, really useful. We have to apply them. We have to sort of understand them and try to apply them. But we somehow have to try and use them to approach the real Dharma, which isn't fully contained in the words. So we need to be open to something beyond the words, some sort of spirit that's behind the words, that we can't completely put into words. So if we're sensitive to the voice of the Dharma, something beyond the words can sometimes seem to shine through them, like light shining through a stained glass window. That's one way of putting it. Or we could say that the words are there, but they're sort of perfumed with something about the enlightened mind. They carry a perfume from beyond themselves, something ineffable that we can almost taste, something more than their literal meaning. So I don't know if I can communicate this, and I don't know if you've had this experience, but I sometimes find myself, I might be reading a Dharma text, and okay, it's interesting, it's really interesting. Okay, it makes sense, it seems true. And okay, I can see it would be really useful if I could apply it to my life, it might be transformative if I could actually put this into practice. And that's all great, that's all great. But there's something else coming through to me as well. There's something about the feel of this. There's something about it. I'm getting something else. It's as though the words carry a charge, or that the text itself carries a charge, a feeling of something beyond, something that seems to point to something beyond the words. There's something coming off this that, I mean, the only word I can think of, which doesn't do it and has got too many Christian connotations, is holy. It's the holy Dharma. There's something big behind. There's something numinous, which has got no necessary connotations of God, but there's something coming through this which is more than those words that makes me realize why in some parts of the East a text would be venerated. There's something coming down to us through this which is more than just the words. There's something numinous coming off this scruffy paperback, translated into limping, stilted English. But there's something more. There's something more. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but I think it's something that few of us might have sort of had the sense of. It's like when we enter a text like that, it's like we're entering a different world. We're entering a world of a mind that's at a different level than ours. And we get a sort of breeze from that world blowing towards us. So I think that we can get that sort of feeling. We get that sort of feeling because expressions of the Dharma, the true Dharma, do spring from the enlightened mind. And they still have the flavour of the enlightened mind about them. The flavour of the Buddha. So we really need to be aware of that connection to the enlightened mind, that connection to the Buddha, when we talk about the Dharma, when we think about the Dharma, when we study the Dharma. We need to remember it's not just any old teaching. It's not something that someone clever thought up on the same level as all the self-help books and bookshop. It comes from another dimension. It comes from a higher realm, another dimension and experience. And we need to do that. We need to remember that. So it's useful to really connect the Dharma with the Buddha. So that's why we're going to start our exploration of the Dharma by linking it firmly to the Buddha, linking it firmly back to the five Buddhas we've been talking about. So So this week we're talking about the Dharma in a very general sense, and linking it to the activity of Virochana, the illuminator that shines the light of the Dharma into our world. What we're going to do is and now we're going to go, okay? We're going to reverse back through the mandala. Tonight looking at Virochana, and the Dharma in a general sense. And then next week, reversing back to Amoghasiddhi. And we're going to look at what we're going to call Amoghasiddhi teachings. Teachings about action and karma. So Amoghasiddhi is the head of the karma family, the action family. He's associated with the unstoppable action of the enlightened mind. And at a lower level, he represents the way we move towards enlightenment by our actions, by activity in the world. So we'll look at Amoghasiddhi teachings on the law of karma, on ethics, on actions and their consequences, and how we can use the law of actions and consequences to grow, to move in a positive direction. Then we're going to move back to Amitabha teachings. Amitabha sits in the mudra of meditation, and he's the red of warm emotion. So we're going to spend some time exploring Dharma teachings that descend to us from, that come down to us from this aspect of the enlightened mind, the aspect that's to do with meditation and the cultivation of positive emotion. It's just metta. After that, we're going to reverse further around the mandala to Ratnasambhava and look at Ratnasambhava teachings on the path of altruism, of the practice of generosity, of giving our gifts to the world. So Ratnasambhava's hand gesture is held in the gesture of giving. And all the imagery associated with him is to do with riches and beauty. And he represents the enriching, beautifying activity of the enlightened mind, the way an enlightened being, the enlightened mind, enriches wherever it is. It's giving to the world, enriching the world. And for us, he represents the element in our practice that's to do with giving our gifts to the world, serving a higher cause than our own desires, playing our part in the enlightened activity of making the world a richer and more beautiful place. And then lastly, we'll look at the Akshobhya teachings, teachings on wisdom. Akshobhya is associated with, he's a blue Buddha associated with the dawn. The imagery is of cool, slightly perhaps more cerebral approach to the Dharma. He's associated with the wisdom that sees all things exactly as they are, with crystal clarity, the crystal clarity of a diamond. And he's associated with the sharp cutting action of the enlightened mind that cuts through all fog and unclarity and sees reality just as it is. So as we get back around to where we started on the mandala, we'll look at how this aspect of the enlightened mind speaks to us through the Dharma, how the ideas of the Dharma, the practices of the Dharma, help us to see things more as they really are. So that's what we'll be doing over the next 4 weeks. More than 4 weeks. Next few weeks, we'll be looking at the Dharma through these symbols, connecting the Dharma back to the enlightened mind, the aspects of the enlightened mind from which they spring. So for the rest of this evening, I'd like to change the subject slightly, approach it from a different tack, and talk about some other things about the nature of the Dharma. So I'd like to go right back to the Buddha's enlightenment. That's where the Dharma comes from. The Dharma flows down to us from the Buddha's enlightenment. So the Buddha had this experience that's the culmination of this long process of growth. He broke through to the nature of reality. He broke through to a completely different level of being. And after his enlightenment, he took some time to digest it. This was a serious experience. He'd seen the way things are. And he sat down and he thought about it. And he thought about it for some considerable time. And he digested the experience. And we're told that he thought, well, there's no way I can communicate this. There's absolutely no way I can communicate this. It's an experience, it's incommunicable. I can't get this across to anyone. So I might as well sit here under this rather nice tree and enjoy myself. I think this is metaphor, because I think it's inherent in enlightenment that it must be passed on, it must become a way of beautifying the world, spreading to others. But that there's a sort of story behind this. So that's the story that he thought, can't say anything about this, nothing to say. I mean, it might be difficult for us to imagine why that might be, but actually we can never understand an experience that we haven't had. So, I mean, an analogy that I'm sorry if you heard it before from me before is something like a colour blue. If we were sighted people who knew the colour blue and we tried to explain the colour blue to someone who had been blind from birth, it would be quite impossible. And what we'd be reduced to doing is stepping down through these... without the reality of the colour blue, we'd have to step it down to words. And we might say things like, blue's a sort of cool colour. It's a bit like water, it's cool. Or we might, no, blue is a really warm colour. It's like the warmth of a summer's day. And the person would think, what's he on about? Is it cool or is it warm? Come on. And nothing we could say about the colour blue would convey the experience of the colour blue to that person.
person?
Nothing. There's no way we could give that experience. And the Buddha is something similar, something but on a much bigger level, the experience of reality. He's thinking, well, I could say it's like this, I could say it's like that. They'll both be misleading. What can I say? But then we're told, or the story goes, that he had a vision. So he had a vision of a lotus pond. He had a vision of humanity as a lotus pond. And in the lotus pond, so lotuses like water lilies, except they're tropical, and they like water lilies, they grow in the muck and the mud at the bottom of sort of still waters, of snow flowing waters, and so some lotuses are right down in the mud. And some lotuses are growing up through the water, and some lotuses are near the top of the water and they can see the sun, the sunshine shining on them, and some lotuses are actually out in the air and the sunshine is shining on them. And we're told that that vision of humanity as a bed of lotuses at different stages of the growth came with the idea, well, I suppose the way, I can help them, I can help the lotuses to grow. I can help them to open up, and then they will be able to experience what I've experienced. Some are near there. Some are near there. Some can be helped to open up in the sunshine. Others need to be helped to grow in their various different stages that they're at. And that this, we're told that this is what decided the Buddha to teach the Dharma. So the Buddha decided, well, folk may not be able to understand what I'm saying, they may not be able to have the experience I've had, I can't convey it to them, but I can help them to have it for themselves by helping them to grow. So they can see it for themselves. And this tells us something about the Dharma. This tells us something about the Dharma, which I think explains some of the problems we might have with the Dharma. The Dharma's huge. Go into our bookshop. You can find books, you think, is this the same as this? You know, one comes from a particular school in Tibet, another one from Japan, you could almost think they're talking about doing different things sometimes. I mean, if you go on Amazon, how many books could you find on Amazon about the Dharma? And some of them you just find really totally confusing. Well, is this the same thing? I mean, they're telling me that I ought to do this, and that's not what they say down the Buddhist center. They're telling me I ought to sort of do this vase breathing and focus it on my inner fire and, whatever. So we might think, well, what on earth is the Dharma? Well, the fact is that much of the Dharma is a horticultural manual about the cultivation of lotuses. Okay? It's a practical handbook on growing lotuses. It's not trying to tell us how things are, it's telling us how to grow or how to grow lotuses. And that can be very confusing because it can lead to some confusion because what people need to grow and the means available to help them grow vary from place to place and from time to time. So we might get, just an example, a horticultural manual on the growing of lotuses in medieval Tibet, where it never rains. And it might say the first thing to do is go and find where there's going to be some snowmelt and dig a channel down to your pond, create a pond and dig a channel from the snowmelt. That's the first thing you must do with the growing of lotuses, otherwise you won't get any water. And then you go and get some yak dung, and you line your pond with yak dung. So you read this and you think, my God, where do I get yak dung? Do I really have to dig? Where do I find snow melt? We can fill the pond from the mains, and we can buy compost from the garden centre. The fact that you taken literally, the yak dung and the snow melt thing is not very useful in 21st century United Kingdom. We don't need to dig a channel for the snow melt, we can't find yak dung. The fact is that you can't grow lotuses in the UK without a greenhouse, which might not be mentioned in a lotus growing manual that comes from Thailand, where you can grow lotuses without a greenhouse. So the bookshops are full of growing lotuses in medieval Tibet, How to do it in medieval Tibet, China, Japan, Thailand, all sorts of places. And that can be incredibly confusing, because what we need to do is look at the principles. We need to look at the principles. You need water. You need nutrients. You need warmth. You need sunshine. You might get those in quite different ways in different places. And the needs might be quite different in different places. No need to provide extra warmth in Thailand. No need to dig a channel for snow melt in the UK. Okay? So we have got different things. We've got things that they don't have in medieval Tibet, and we perhaps have got problems that they don't have as well. So that's one of the reasons that we try and steer clear in our movement of just following any one of the historical traditions of Buddhism. It's not necessary to find the Yakdong. So much of the Dharma is what we call method. Much of the Dharma is what we call method. It's a horticultural manual on the growing of lotuses. So we have method. And then another aspect of the Dharma is what we call doctrine. And it's quite important to make this distinction. Method is method. And sometimes people get very confused about this because, for example, you can go to the Pali Canon and it will tell you about the how to... a really contentious one, just to how to, if you're a monk in medieval, wherever it was, how you can meditate on women's bodies so that they seem really ugly to you. Because, my God, this is a misogynistic, thinks women are really ugly. It's got nothing to do with it, it's method, okay? These poor guys, there's these young guys out there, they're celibate, living in a tropical country. They've got a real problem on their hands with sexual desire, right? So there's a method here about how do you step back from sexual desire. Doesn't mean that the Dharma holds that women are these evil creatures. That's just a slightly contentious example, but there's lots like that. There's lots like that where it's method. It's about particular circumstances, particular problems people might have. And then we've got doctrine. And doctrine, okay, it's a little bit more general than method. It's still not the truth. It's still not the truth, because the truth is the reality. The truth is the reality. But doctrine is attempts to express the truth in words and ideas. It's sometimes called right view. It's what the Buddha says, well, it's what the Dharma says, that, well, actually these are really helpful ways of thinking. These are ways of thinking that are aligned with reality. They're more aligned with reality than our usual ways of thinking, and they're helpful. It's really helpful to realize that things are impermanent. It's really helpful to realize that we're not fixed ourselves, etc., etc. So there are attempts to express truths that go beyond words and concepts in words and concepts. And it's related to what we call right view. Now, this aspect of the Dharma can sometimes be a bit denigrated. It can sometimes be a bit denigrated. I mean, I think people who've sort of been, as I myself was, a bit exposed to sort of Kod Zen. So Kod Zen says, well, you don't study, it's all, just meditate, and, you know, go beyond words and ideas. And I think that's sunk into the way some of us think about the Dharma. But actually, it's really important to study, practice, soak ourselves in these ideas. And that's why we put an emphasis on things like talks. That's why we have an emphasis on talks like this, on studying the Dharma. We, you know, if you're more involved in our movement, you'll find we do a lot of Dharma study. And sometimes people say, oh, well, what's all that about? I don't need to know all of that. I only need to know one line of Dharma to get enlightened, or whatever. So there is a sort of fashion to denigrate this, but we do this, we have this aspect of just dwelling on the Dharma, studying the Dharma, because the ideas that the Dharma presents are transformative in their own right. If we make them part of our thinking, we've got loads of ideas already. Most of them are just a hodgepodge of stuff we've got from our society and our culture and our era. But if we make the ideas of the Dharma part of our thinking, they colour the way we act, and they colour the way we speak, and they colour the way we think, so that our life the way we act, speak and think becomes more aligned with reality. The ideas of the Dharma are not reality, but they're more aligned with reality than the ideas that are in common circulation. So they colour the way we see the world, and they colour the way we respond to the world and the way we act in the world. So we need to immerse ourselves in the Dharma, soak ourselves in the Dharma, so that the Dharma soaks into us and colours us right from the inside out, so that it colours the way we see things, the way we think. There's a phrase that sometimes gets repeated, which I always really like, which is, non-repetition is the canker of the spiritual life. I quite like that. It's really difficult to give talks on Sangha like loads and loads and loads without repeating yourself. But non-repetition is the canker of the spiritual life. Because actually the way we get somewhere with the Dharma is to keep repeating it to ourselves. We keep putting it in over and over again. Our minds are like sieves. Well, maybe yours isn't, but you'll be very unusual. Our minds are like sieves. We can pour stuff in and it just pours out. We have to pour it in really, really fast and keep pouring it in, and eventually some of it sticks. So non-repetition is the canker of the spiritual life. If we go over it from different angles, in different ways, over and over again, it starts to stick, and it starts to sink in, and it starts to change the way we see things. And when it changes the way we see things, it transforms our life, and it starts to transform our life in really positive ways, because the way we're thinking and acting becomes more in accord with reality. And also, we need to immerse ourselves in the Dharma. We need to keep going back to the Dharma, study the Dharma, talk about the Dharma, hear talks about the Dharma, because connection with the Dharma connects us with something beyond the Dharma. So connection with the words of the Dharma connects us with reality. It connects us with the enlightened mind. It strengthens our connection to the enlightened mind. Reading a text can be like an act of meditation. It's a text composed, written, or stemming from someone who exists on a higher dimension than we do. Someone who exists in a higher state, on a higher level. And just going into that text with our mind, we start to live for a little while in that higher level, in that higher dimension, that higher realm of being. It affects us. It refines us. It's like visiting heaven. It's like visiting a different realm. And what it does as well is it strengthens our connection to those higher realms. It strengthens our connection to the enlightened mind. We've all got a connection to the enlightened mind, and we wouldn't be here. It all speaks to us in some way, even if we can't sort of really put a finger on it. We've got a connection. There's a sort of string from us going to the enlightened mind somewhere, and it's sort of reeling us in. And just connection with the Dharma at this level helps reality reel us in. Okay? It's like the hook. It strengthens our connection to these higher realms. We need to just keep coming back to the Dharma. The Dharma is not, talking about the Dharma, reading about the Dharma is not a distraction. It's not just all about meditation. We need that connection. And that was true in the Buddha's time. The Buddha talked about that. He talked about talking the Dharma as a really important part of what the practitioners did. They talked to the Dharma because talking the Dharma improved their connection to him and to the reality that he was, as it were, imbued with. And even more now that the Buddha's not here, we can't connect directly with him, we need to just keep connecting with the Dharma as our way of connecting ourselves back to the Buddha, back to the enlightened mind, back to what we could become. So we'll see more about that next week, and that's what we'll be looking at, how we can do that in different ways over the coming weeks.